on the line. Live on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader. Online at ESPNAU.com or on the ESPN 106.7 app. To be on the line, call in at 334-321-1390 or toll free at 888-382-7502. You are on the line with Jacob Goetz.
You're on the line here on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika sports leader. Happy Wednesday, everybody. Hope you're doing well on this June 11th, 2025. This is On the Line, the show that tells you like it is and holds nothing back. I'm your man, Jacob Goetz. And you got me for the next 2 hours right here on ESPN 106.7. It is a beautiful day in the Auburn Opelika area. It is hot. My goodness. It is very toasty outside, and so we are happy to be working inside. We've got a lot to bring to you on the show today. The U.S. Open opens up tomorrow. U.S. Open begins tomorrow. The third major of the year is upon us, and so I'm going to talk about that a little bit in terms of who you should be looking out for, who the betting favorites are, and just how hard that course is going to play up in Pennsylvania, so we'll talk about that. Plus, we have some scheduling news for Auburn football as the time slots for every single game have been announced. We don't know exact times, but we know a roundabout on when the games will be played. Plus, college basketball made some rules changes yesterday right as we were going off the air. We'll have a chance to talk about that today. And then, it's Double D Wednesday. Daryl Dapperts will be joining us here on the show, so we're looking forward to that in hour number two. But in the studio with me, as he is every single day, my man Christian Griffin, how are you, sir? Happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday. Yeah, you mentioned it. Bit of a hot day outside today and hoping that everything can cool off rather quickly. Man, about 5 minutes before getting on air, we had to throw around the time slots a little bit just because we got some time slots that we are very, very excited to be able to dive into, talking a little bit about what some of these games could be. If for those that have not heard it, Auburn and Georgia will be a night game inside Jordan-Hare Stadium. Anywhere from a 5 to a 7 o'clock p.m. kickoff Central Time inside Jordan-Hare. Man, what that could be. This season has everything that it could possibly hope for in front of it. We'll talk a little bit about what Auburn could look like up at that point before that game. Coming off the bye week, man, should be what we hope is a very, very exciting game. You mentioned the U.S. Open starting tomorrow. Some Auburn baseball news in there as well. And then Auburn basketball, kind of looking at the hoop schedule so far, right? We don't have all of the dates. But where do these teams play each other? When do these teams play each other? When does Auburn go to this location or this location? Who's before? Who's after? We'll talk about some of the schedule that Auburn has in the non-conferences. It should be a very, very exciting non-conference slate once again, but really excited to be able to dive into that here today.
And so with it being Double D Wednesday with Daryl Dapperts coming up in the second hour, we won't have the phone lines open then. So tell you what, we'll go ahead and open them right now. If you want to be a part of the show, if you want to call in and talk to us to give us your thoughts on anything that we're talking about today, you are more than welcome to do that. Give us a call, 334-321-1390. Actually, we encourage it. We'd love to hear from you on this Wednesday afternoon, 334-321-1390. Your picks for the U.S. Open, your thoughts on the schedule stuff for Auburn football, Auburn basketball, things like that, or Auburn baseball news. All of that is going to be here in the first hour. And so, again, give us a call, 334-321-1390. Or you can shoot us a text in the On the Line text box. That number, which is always open, is 334-784-1067. And for our golf fans out there, or even for the maybe casual to non-golf fans, this is a big week because it's one of the four majors of the year. And the U.S. Open is here. It will begin tomorrow morning up in Pennsylvania. And we've seen so many pictures and videos and breakdowns of what this golf course is going to look like, Christian, and it's going to be a rough week for the best players in the world to even break par. I mean, that seems to be what the consensus is the fact that the cut line could be +7 or +8, and the winner might be two or three under par if they're lucky.
Yeah, it's going to be absolutely incredible. This is kind of the weekend. You don't want to see this year round, but you also don't want to see the 32, 33 under par. You want that middle ground, but you've gotten a couple of those really, really easy tournaments. In a U.S. Open, you want this to be one where people struggle. You want to be able to relate to some aspect of this game. There were a bunch of interviews going out over at Oakmont asking some of the tour players, what would an 18 handicap shoot? Basically, if you were a bogey golfer, what would you shoot, or what would they shoot if they went out and played this course? And a bunch of them joked and said, well, how many balls do you get? Do you get ball spotters? Are you able to do certain things? And about half of them said anywhere from 120 to 150. Mm. The other ones were saying they probably wouldn't even finish. Your patience, your aggression would not be able to allow you to truly finish a round. But 150 was kind of that number. And, man, it's crazy to think about, because we don't consider ourselves great, but we don't consider ourselves too bad. But,
sure,
man, if we went out and shot numbers like that, I might put the clubs up. Facebook Marketplace might be the very next place for all of my clubs.
The U.S. Open is one where, of course, these majors, other than the Masters, they rotate the courses that they play at, which could be a little confusing for some. It's like, well, how can you judge different U.S. Open champions if they're sure playing in different courses and conditions and things? But that's just kind of how golf is, and that's honestly what makes it a little bit different than almost any other sport. I mean, the atmosphere changes with what you're playing in. And so I get the confusion there, maybe even the uproar about that. But the U.S. Open is one where you see any sort and all sorts of scores. You've seen U.S. Open winners with 15, 20, 25 under par. You've seen some that have been flirting with even the Open, right? The British Open, or just, you know, the Open is one that you always see people struggle. That's the one they play over in Scotland or Ireland or things like that, where it's always raining, it's windy, it's cold, it's just nasty weather to be playing golf in. Augusta seems like people have figured it out over the years, and they've done a few tweaks here and there to make it a little bit harder. And then the PGA Championship is normally a pretty low-scoring tournament as well. And so the U.S. Open is just kind of that wild card. It really just depends on who's in it, where they are, and what the conditions are. But it's going to be tough this year. And, of course, Bryson DeChambeau is the defending U.S. Open champion. He'll be trying to go back-to-back this year at the U.S. Open, and I'm trying to decide who to pick and why, and it's not even about necessarily the name. It's about the style that they play, right? It's about, okay, do you find the fairway? How good are your short irons to long irons? How good is your scrambling? Can you putt, Scotty? Can you putt and keep it on the green? I've seen videos, and I heard Doug talking earlier too about people dropping and trying to putt 3 and 4 feet away and losing it off the green. Like, this is going to be a really difficult tournament in your mind, Christian, just off of the course knowledge that we know and the players that are going to be here. Of course, some of the best in the world. What type of player is going to win this week?
Not being the simple, stupid, oh, well, if you hit the fairway, then you hit the green. But you feel like in a tournament like this, it's all of those things that are highlighted, even more emphasized, because you can see players win a tournament and their fairway in regulation or fairway off the tee is 33%. But they're just so good at scrambling, or sometimes the rough is not bad whatsoever. If you hit the rough, you can already almost guarantee yourself another stroke on every single hole. I look at guys that are very, very confident in their ability to either A, pull off difficult shots, or B, ones that feel like they can get up and down not using a driver. The driver, I think, is going to be the most important club for anybody this entire week. And that's why you've heard so many people talk about it. This is a tournament where these shorter hitters could almost be favored, just simply because there's less room for error. Yes, it might only go, we consider it pretty good, but 260, 270 versus the 320, 330, or the Bryson DeChambeaus of the world that can get you 350 if he really needs to. Yes, that makes it a whole lot shorter, but guys like Bryson with distance control and speed and spin, things like that, while hitting off of or while hitting out of rough that's 5 inches tall, not knowing what it's going to do, which way it's growing, which way it's going to affect your ball, then the mud balls come into play. So much comes down to what you can do getting off the tee box.
Yeah, and there's so many names that you look at, and it's like, well, I could see him win. Well, I could see him win. Why? You could convince me that this guy wins. How about John Rahm? Seen a lot of people starting to pick John Rahm, and a lot of the experts at ESPN who will have most of the coverage this week at Oakmont starting tomorrow morning. Lots of people have picked John Rahm. Most people have picked Scottie Scheffler just because he is the hottest player in golf right now, and it's not even the fact that he's hot. It's just the fact that he is good. His betting odds, Christian, are the best we've seen in a major since Tiger Woods was in his prime. We're talking 20, 25 years ago when Tiger Woods was dominating the golf world, winning majors by 15 and 20 strokes at a time. Scottie Scheffler, I saw it finalized today, plus 275 to win the tournament, which is the best betting odds in a major since Tiger Woods was dominating the game of golf. That is incredible to see.
It's incredible, and to think that if he's leading after Thursday, that number could move to right around even.
That's stupid.
It's a crazy thought that one hole can change everything so drastically, but with a player like Scottie, he's the closest thing that we've seen. And yes, we were young to where we weren't able to watch the over prime and remember too much of the prime Tiger other than just the highlights and the videos and stuff, but crazy to think that what we see with Scottie, he has to do for another decade to live up to the week's ranked number one and the tournament wins, things like that, to even come close to be in some sort of discussion of taking over that number one spot.
Scottie has 3 major championship wins under his belt, 2 at Augusta, and then he just won the PGA Championship a few weeks ago. So this would be his 3rd of the 4 in need of the Grand Slam. Most of the folks at ESPN are picking him. I mean, it's hard not to pick the greatest player in the game right now. It just seems like that would be too easy, right? It seems like, at what point does he slow down? What course is it, or which course is it that kind of gets its arms around him and makes it difficult for him? Very well could be this, or he could just be so dang good that it doesn't even matter. A lot of picks for Scottie Scheffler, seen some John Rahms in there, seems to be about the second most popular pick of the folks at ESPN. Seen some Sepp Strakas out there. You and I were talking at lunch about Colin Morikawa. It could be a good bet as well. I've thought about somebody like Ludvig Åberg as well. Funny how nobody's picking Rory. Haven't seen a whole lot of people jumping on McIlroy to win this tournament, and I think it's because he struggles right now to find the fairway. He's not playing his best golf. He just missed the cut, I believe, at the Canadian Open last week.
Yeah.
So he's not playing his best golf, but you also mentioned Xander Schauffele could be somebody to keep an eye on this week.
I do. I again, thinking more about it, are we picking 3?
I think so. I think we should pick 3. 3 names that we think could win, or if you had to pick 3 names to drop a little something on or sprinkle a little something on to win the tournament, who would it be? That can be based off of who you just flat out think is going to win, maybe their betting value, whatever the case may be. 3 names for you that you believe could or will win the U.S. Open this week. Again, all of that starts tomorrow. Tee times begin at like 6 or 6:30 in the morning. Incredible pairings, by the way. Awesome pairings for this. But yeah, 3 names for you. And we can repeat it or, you know, have the same answers. It's
sure.
Okay. But 3 names for you.
No, in no particular order, I am going John Rahm, Sepp Straka. And for no reason other than the fact that, no, I can't do that. I'm going to go Shane Lowry.
Shane Lowry, okay. Him and Rory are playing together tomorrow and Friday, which I thought is very interesting since they're like best friends.
That's a scary one. The emotions.
He's been playing good golf, though. He was right there in it in the PGA Championship.
But with how frustrating this course is, it's more of a mental challenge than a physical challenge.
Yeah.
And he might need to bring 3 sets of every single club. Ooh.
You got to bet on Cameron Young, who's missed 4 out of his first 5 cuts this year. First 5 tournaments he's played this year, all 5 that he's played this year, he's missed the cut in 4 of them.
Oh, my gosh.
But He's coming off a T4 at the Canadian Open last week.
Every part of me wants to go Keegan Bradley because of how fitting would that be for Captain America to win, win the U.S. Open.
That'd be sweet.
I don't know if I can go that far, though. I have my two for sure, and it's Sepp Straka and it's John Rahm. I'm trying to find, do you have a third, or do you have your
I have mine. I'm going Colin Morikawa. I think that's a great pick. I think somebody who just is fundamentally sound, one that does tend to find the fairway, and one that I trust to putt as well, for the most part. A guy that when he's locked in, he's one of the best, but it is flaky at times with Colin. But this week is not about can you make the long bombs, can you knock it in from deep. This is about can you have distance control on putting. Can you not let it roll off the green? Can you leave it short on purpose? Can you drop it in the cup on – I mean, all those things. I'm going to pick Colin Morikawa. I'm going to pick – am I allowed to pick Scotty? I always pick Scotty. I mean, how could you not?
That's our fourth with an asterisk. I think Colin is my third as well.
I like Colin a lot.
We talked
week.
About him at lunch, and I was going to try and find somebody different, but looking at it right now, where he hits 73% of his fairways,
it's hard to argue it, man. It really
Aaron
really
Ryzik there with 72% of his fairways hit too.
That's not bad. That's not bad at all. Yeah, I think everybody's going to pick Scotty, and so yeah, we'll make that the community play. Everybody wins when Scotty wins. I like how that plays out. So I'm going with Colin as one of mine. I'm going to pull up what are the current odds right now, just to kind of see what the.
Well, while you're looking at that, let me show you, or let me for if we haven't heard about the green speeds and the stimping, things like that. A stimp is referring to the measurement of how fast a golf ball rolls basically off. If you see the videos of the little device with the angle, essentially as if you were to hit it, the average stimp, the green speeds of majors are around 12 to 13. Some courses can run a 10 or 11. Oakmont, they're saying it was running at a 14 and a half or 15.
Yeah, that's tough, man.
Just, I mean, again, even if you don't necessarily know what those numbers mean, it's essentially as if it's rolling that many feet from where they're designed to drop it from on the average center part of the green from that one device.
A name that I said at lunch, and I think I said it already on the show, Ludvig, I think is a really good bet this week. Oberg, I think he's somebody who is just always there. He reminds me of the younger Scotty, who is just always around. He's always in contention. So I'm going Colin Morikawa. I'm going Ludvig Oberg. The community play is Scotty Scheffler. If he wins, you all win. And then I need an outlier. Who is my...
Tommy Fleetwood.
How about Daniel Berger? We could put him in there. Patrick Reed, you said him.
I said Fleetwood.
I thought you said... Oh, you did? Did you say Fleetwood?
That was the one I just named out.
Oh, okay.
Sepp Straka was my other one.
I got it. A guy that's been playing good. A guy that I'm not a major fan of, but one that seems to be... This is my
Brooks
top
Koepka.
15. No. no. My pick to be a top 15 guy, flirting with a top 10 this week, Justin Rose, someone who doesn't need to hit driver if he doesn't want to. I don't know if I necessarily trust the putting all the time from him, but Justin Rose is somebody who's just been hanging around in his older age. This year has been one of his better years we've seen recently from him, so that's my three. Colin Morikawa, Ludvig Oberg, and then Justin Rose.
All right, on our way out. A star that does not make the cut.
Define star.
A name that the casual golfer is able to to say that they have heard.
Justin Thomas. Jordan Spieth.
Yeah, those are my yeah.
I mean, Brooks. I think all three of those are in.
Throw Rory in there. Phil.
Yeah. What about Hideki? Anybody ever talk about Hideki Matsuyama, who always is just kind of there? I don't trust him off the tee. I don't trust Hideki off the tee at all. Yeah. That's what I'm going with. I like it. U.S. Open begins tomorrow. We'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow when it starts on Friday for sure for a free-for-all Friday. But third major of the year, it begins tomorrow at Oakmont. More updates to come when it begins tomorrow. We'll take our first break here in hour number one. Come back with some big-time Auburn baseball news. A star freshman is returning for another season. We'll tell you who and we'll tell you why after this here on ESPN 106.7.
War Eagle, this is Coach Bruce Pearl, and you're on the line with Jacob Goins on Auburn Opelika Sports Leader ESPN 106.7.
We continue on here on the Wednesday edition of On the Line on ESPN 106.7 as we are off and running during the Wednesday edition of the show. And we saw some news earlier today for Auburn baseball. While the season is over and will not be competing in the College World Series in Omaha, great news for what Auburn is going to have and look like next year, particularly on the mound, in terms of a freshman who just got better as the year went on, developed into a very reliable guy on the hump, and somebody who announced he's returning to the Plains.
Yeah, Andreas Alvarez announced that he will be returning for his sophomore campaign. I guess not the official I'm back post, but excited to do this in year two. We'll see you at Plainsman next year, Auburn family. Things along that matter. But again, on all the social medias posted it and was a guy that, yeah, you mentioned it, continued to get better, continued to grow in the confidence. We saw him in the regional come out and, again, get his name called, and it came a little bit as a surprise to some folks, us included. And what did he do? Came out throwing 95, 96, and mowed everybody down. Got the start in game two against, I almost said NC State, against Coastal Carolina, and did his job there as well. And so, again, a very reliable starter that you got to use in year one, that you fully expect to take that big jump to sophomore year. Really, really excited to be able to get the flamethrower back.
Yeah, he ended up with a 3-1 record this year, 4.8 ERA, 14 appearances, started in 9 total games, 45 innings pitched, gave up 47 hits, just 27 runs, only 24 of those were earned. Gave up 4 homers, but only had 18 walks and had, trying to find his strikeout number. Am I just overlooking him? Do I not see it? I guess I don't. Maybe.
Don't worry. You keep talking. I'll find it.
Yeah, go ahead and find it, because I'm just not seeing it at the moment. So, but you're right. I mean, somebody who I think was questionable at times, not him in particular, but even us or fans wondering, okay, is this the right decision? Is this the right move? And then he, more times than not, just completely proved everybody wrong.
Yeah, through 41 innings, had 43 hits, 27 runs, 33 strikeouts to 16 walks. And so you'd expect that number to make a little bit of a drop, as well as the opponent batting average hitting .272. But a lot of those came the second and third time through the lineup, which is why a big question mark with the Coastal Carolina game of why are you pulling him so early? He only thrown 50 or 60 pitches, but they were about to go there their way through the lineup for the third time, and so that's when some of those numbers skew a little bit. But again, a freshman number in the SEC, those are your numbers. I think you will happily live with that, and you expect all of those, except for the win total, to drop this time next year, and maybe the innings pitched and strikeouts as well.
So do you expect him to be firmly in the starting rotation next year on a weekend, whether it be Friday, Saturday, Sunday, kind of what Auburn would plan to throw out there in the SEC this time next year?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that should be the expectation for himself. It should be for the pitching staff as well, again, with a couple of the other guys that you're bringing in, whether the freshman arms or the guys from the transfer portal that have already been in that starting rotation. But how nice is it to be able to have 3, 4, 5 guys that could go out and compete for those 3 starting spots, and the other ones still get plenty of usage during the weekend as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you look through some of the guys that Auburn brought in through the transfer portal. Remember Drew Whalen, the Western Kentucky guy, who's 6'1", 215, the righty, who had a 3.53 ERA this season and 81 and two-thirds innings pitched. Pretty good. 90 strikeouts, 31 walks for Mr. Drew Whalen. You also bring in was looking for Garrett Brewer. There he is, the Michigan State kid who we talked about the other day. Somebody who's got powerful experience. He's 6'3", the lefty, who's going to be coming in after a couple of years at Michigan State. And so you feel that Auburn, yes, has to replace some in the pitching rotation, but you've gotten some through the portal, you have a lot coming back, and you feel like you've got one of the better recruiting classes in the country across the board. And so the expectation, I would think, is that Auburn baseball should be, yet again, one of the most talented teams in the country next year.
Yeah, you're also bringing in Jake Marciano from Virginia Tech, who is the 14th ranked transfer portal addition. Again, Ryan Farber, number 15. Waylon's listed as the 50th, but everybody is very, very high on him. Todd Clay from the infield, and then, as you mentioned, Garrett Brewer early in the 200 spots. But all of these guys you feel like are going to be very, very important, very key additions. And I'm trying to see what the recruiting class looked like for Auburn baseball. Had it up just a second ago.
It's highly ranked. I don't remember exactly where it ended up, but pretty high. Well, we can find it.
I was going to say, I'm trying to pull it up.
Yeah, we can find it. That's okay. Well, Auburn baseball has Andreas Alvarez coming back for another year. Has, again, a really good freshman season, and expect a sophomore surge next year for Butch Thompson and the Tigers. But we're talking Auburn football when we come back, because not exactly kickoff times, but time slots have been announced. And if you haven't seen it, you're going to want to hear it. We'll talk about that and why there are some exciting games coming up in Jordan-Hare this season. We're talking that coming up next.
On the line with Jacob Goins on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader.
30 minutes into hour number one here on the Wednesday edition of On the Line on ESPN 106.7. He is Christian Griffin. I'm Jacob Goins. We appreciate you being with us. Phone lines are open if you want to be a part of the show. We highly encourage that you do so by giving us a call at 334-321-1390. What's on your mind? What do you want to talk about here on the show today? And I have a feeling that some of you are going to have some thoughts, some opinions on the schedule release for Auburn football and all the teams around the SEC. And you may be saying, well, we've known the schedule for a while. Yes, we've also known kickoff times for the first three games, but now we know the kickoff time slots for the rest of the season. And what this means is we don't know the exact time of kickoff, but we have an idea, Christian, on when all of these games are going to be. We'll start with Auburn and then kind of work our way in other games that stick out to us. But there's either the early window, the afternoon window, the night window, or the flex window. And there are different times assigned to each one of those. So we now know at least somewhat when Auburn will be playing all their football games this fall.
Yeah, we knew the first three with Baylor on the Friday night in Waco at 7 p.m. You then have the kickoff on the Plains against Ball State, a 6:30 start. South Alabama for homecoming, the 11:45 a.m. slot. We knew those three, but all of the SEC time slots have been released. Oklahoma, Auburn's first SEC game, is that flex spot in Norman, which again could go anywhere from 2:30 to 7 p.m. Basically, the flex window covers the afternoon and the night. It can be anywhere from the 2:30 to the 7 p.m. start. Afternoon game at Texas A&M, which will be the 2:30 to the 3:30 game. You can imagine that being a very, very exciting game. And then the one that everybody is very, very excited for, after the bye week, after A&M, you then have a confirmed night game in Jordan-Hare on October 11th when Georgia comes to town. The first night game since 2012, which I don't remember what happened in that game.
No, but we don't have to talk about it.
But October 11th, a night game. It will be a 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. kickoff somewhere in that time slot. You then go right back to it with the flex slot against Missouri. Arkansas will be an early kick. Kentucky will be a flex. Vanderbilt will be the afternoon. The Mercer game has been confirmed for a 1 o'clock start. And then home against Alabama is a flex spot as well. All of those, very, very exciting. The one that sticks out, the one that's already confirmed to be the night game, though, is October 11th when Georgia comes to town.
I mean, what an opportunity, right? What a chance for Auburn to take advantage and put itself back on the map, back in relevancy in college football. Because we've talked so much about the first five games and how important and how difficult they're going to be with not having a significant home game leading up to Georgia, right? You're literally going to play two home games, and both of them are cupcakes. I mean, it's Ball State and South Alabama, which
should be.
I was about to say, should be cupcakes. Then you have, of course, the three games that we've all circled in big red Sharpie: Baylor on the road on a Friday night, Oklahoma on the road in Norman, and then Texas A&M on the road as well. That'll be an afternoon game. Oklahoma's a flex, so anywhere from 2:30 to 7. And so it sets up with what could be one of the best atmospheres we've seen in Jordan-Hare in quite some time. And you and I have been very vocal about this, and I saw our friends on the next round up in Birmingham had this discussion about home field advantages in the SEC, yeah. And they had some major disagreements with Auburn and Jordan-Hare, and I believe it was Lance up there that said, Jordan-Hare's not a home field advantage right now. It's just not. And you and I have been very vocal in saying the exact same thing. When you let Vanderbilt come in here and beat you, you have no more home field advantage. You have no more pride in your house and protecting this house and being big, bad, and tough. When you let Vanderbilt come in here and beat you, or Oklahoma do it the way they did, or letting teams like that in Arkansas, you know, you can't. You can't. Cal, you let California come in here in the second week of August and embarrass you. There is no home field advantage right now for Jordan-Hare Stadium, which it sucks. I hate it.
There's also a difference in crowds and home field advantage. You feel like that's another topic of discussion as well, because I think the crowd can play a big factor or could be still very exciting. However, the product on the field, which is what you're referring to, doesn't make it to where you can say it's the toughest place to play.
But it's clearly not a tough place to play if again, those types of teams are coming in here and playing, because you and I can speak to this, as I'm sure everybody listening to this radio show right now could listen or could speak to this, as if when Auburn's losing to those teams and playing as bad as they've played in the last 5 years, the crowd's not engaged. The crowd's not excited. The crowd doesn't even want to be there. And a lot of people have quit showing up. They quit going. When's the last time you saw Jordan-Hare completely sold out, top to bottom, left to right? It's been a while, and I've been there quite a bit. That place doesn't sell out. And when it's the fourth quarter and Auburn goes three and out again, or turns the ball over again, or does anything stupid again, people don't want to be there for that. They don't want to cheer for that. And you can agree or disagree whether you think that's right or wrong, but that's just a fact. That's just what happens. This is a chance to change that in 2025. You're 4-1 when Georgia comes to town. You're a top 25 team when Georgia comes to town, because I think everybody would agree you go 4-1 against Baylor, OU, 2-1 against Baylor, OU, and Texas A&M. You go 2-1 in those games, you're a top 25 team to start the season.
Which is wild to think that Auburn might be on the verge, if not having a number by their name to start the season off, just because of all these preseason rankings.
Which is wild, in my opinion, but
it's very wild. But again, obviously a 5-0 start would be the best of both worlds, and all of a sudden you have the bye week, and then you have Georgia.
It's a lot to ask.
It is. I feel like that's a little bit unreasonable.
At least right now, anyway, in the middle of June.
Sure. I think that's a little bit unreasonable to ask if all of a sudden you get to 4-0, and it's, okay, well, why can't we go and beat A&M again?
And you've beat the heck out of Baylor and Oklahoma. If you come out with just your hair on fire and it's like, oh, okay, this team is really good,
yes,
then that's a different conversation. But yeah,
I still think regardless, winning both OU and A&M, I think that is a very tall task.
Sure.
I think the expectation should be 3-0, and if you split those two, I don't think that there's too many fans that would be unhappy. We had the conversation of you would rather beat OU, lose to Texas A&M, than I brought up the fact of, from a team standpoint, yes, but you'd rather almost lose, be able to show that you can respond to A&M and be able to build off of that with the bye week. But again, regardless of how it happened, even if the loss came with South Alabama, if I handed you a note and said Auburn will be 4-1 right now, you would take it in a heartbeat. The fact that you have that opportunity now. Then the bye week, and then you have the entire national country watching Auburn and Georgia in a rivalry that has not been too big of a rivalry over the past decade.
Yeah. I mean, it's
you
been
can get lopsided. Everything that you want right back. And then you look at the rest of your schedule after that. The final seven games for this Auburn team, you have two road games. Yeah. You go to Arkansas and you go to Vanderbilt.
That's it. You play Missouri at home in a flex, so a afternoon night game. Kentucky at home in an afternoon or night game. Vanderbilt on the road mid-afternoon where they'll have 25,000 people there. You play Mercer in a game that nobody will watch outside of the Auburn fans, of course. And then Alabama, which is a flex, which will be hopefully a 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, something like that. I mean, you have the chance for Georgia and Alabama to both be under the lights at Jordan-Hare.
And just looking at this, man, I mean,
it's not that bad.
What more of a schedule could you genuinely ask, realistically ask for? This right here, the schedule that we are both looking at with now the time slots next to each team, when you're looking at it, you have OU and Texas A&M. That is the toughest road schedule you have. You play your last seven games, two of them are on the road in Arkansas and Vanderbilt. If you're Hugh Freeze and you're this coaching staff and you're this team and you're wanting to get back to national legitimacy, you're wanting to get back to the national respect, what more of a season could you ask for than what is being blueprinted, handed out in front of you, rough drafted, and you're sitting there looking at this now? This should get you so excited for what the season possibly could be.
I'm looking at it right now for the week of October 11th. That is when Georgia comes to Jordan-Hare Stadium, confirmed as a night game. Looking at the other games on the schedule that weekend in terms of what the national attention could be, a.k.a. College Game Day, SEC Nation, or just everybody in the country talking about what could be a top 25 game. Because you look at Georgia, just for reference, in case people haven't looked at their schedule recently, it's no cakewalk for them to get to Auburn. Same way it's no cakewalk for Auburn to get to Georgia. They start with Marshall and Austin Peay. That's fine. They'll destroy both of those teams. Then they go for their first real game of the year, week three. They go to Tennessee, to Knoxville, to Neyland Stadium on an afternoon game at 2:30 on ABC. Their reward is a bye week before they host Alabama, which is now confirmed as a night game in Athens. Alabama is heading to Athens in a night game. That's going to be incredible, too.
It's good for them.
Yeah.
It's been forever since Sanford Stadium's held a night game.
They needed it.
Being from Georgia, I've heard all about it my entire life. So.
Yeah, they needed it. Then they're going to have Kentucky before they come and play to Auburn. So, reminder, Auburn has a bye week before Georgia. The Dogs play Kentucky. They host them at 11 a.m. They're going to just absolutely destroy them. But it's no cakewalk either. And you would like to think, going at Georgia or at Tennessee and home for Alabama, you'd like to think Georgia has a loss in one of those two games. Even if they do or even if they don't, they're going to be a top 25 team. Heck, they're going to be a top 10 team in college football. Auburn's 4-1. Auburn's a top 25 team. You're talking about a top 25 matchup under the lights in Jordan-Hare for the Deep South's oldest rivalry. What more could you ask for right there? What more could you ask for in looking through the schedule of college football that weekend? I mean,
there's a couple good ones.
There are. South Carolina, LSU could be incredible depending on how those two teams are looking come week 5 and 6.
I mean, what week of that?
That's week 7, technically, yes, of the college football season. You've got Florida, Texas A&M is a great game on there. Michigan, USC is a big one. I mean, Indiana, Oregon could be a big one
if both teams continue to look good.
I'm scrolling like as we speak. I have not even looked all the way down here. Keep going.
The bottom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Alabama, Missouri. You're right. Yep, that's a tough one. Oh.
No, I was not talking about that one. I was talking about the one you just saw.
Yeah, I was joking about Alabama, Missouri.
Okay. NC State, Notre Dame. Yep.
The one right above it.
Yep.
Freaking Red River, man. Come Come on, man.
It's not always.
Come on, but not always, but dang.
Auburn, beat Oklahoma.
Beat Oklahoma. You have to do it to get the relevancy that you deserve. Serious talk, though. Oklahoma could only be 3-2 before Red River because they host Michigan in week two. Could you imagine Michigan and Auburn coming to Norman? Yikes. They should be 4-1. They should absolutely be 4-1 at worst. Illinois State, Michigan at Temple for whatever reason, hosting Auburn and then hosting Kent State before they play Texas at neutral site. Oklahoma's got to be licking their chops, man. That's big. Come on, man. Do the right thing. Do the right thing and put Auburn ABC prime time. They won't. They won't do it. Auburn will be 2-4 when that game shows up, and they'll be like, well, you had your chances, Auburn. Sorry, man. Or 2-3, technically. But, big games that weekend, man. Big games. And then, the rest of the schedule for Auburn in terms of time slots, I mean, nothing else just screams at you. There's no the Baylor game, yes. Being on the road for a night game. Georgia at home for night. Bama's going to be 2:30 and beyond, as it almost always is, right? So there's really no crazy change there. I don't care to go on the road at Fayetteville in an early kickoff. We say all the time, the early kick benefits the road team more times than not. And Auburn has had no problems playing in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Let's be real. Going to Nashville, chance to go there and get one back. You're going to host Missouri and Kentucky. One thing I was telling you as we were coming back, though, for fans who like to go to Auburn games in Jordan-Hare, I don't see.
It's also the schedule for you.
It's the schedule for you because I don't see hardly any games where you're just going to be passing out from heat exhaustion like we have been, I don't know, my entire life, it seems like, because
other than South Alabama, other than homecoming.
Yeah. That's true. Other than South Alabama, there are really no games on here where you're just going to be cooking, right? You play Baylor, but that's on the road. Ball State's a night game. The first home game of the year is at night, 6:30 under the lights. Homecoming, yes, but homecoming, whatever. At Oklahoma, at Texas A&M, bye week, Georgia's a night game.
And even if you go to those, the flex at OU, the afternoon game at Kyle Field.
Still September.
Warm,
but I mean, yeah, still September. But home game-wise, your next afternoon possible game is the Missouri game, which is flex, and that's technically 2:30 to 7, but that's halfway through October. At that point, you're hoping that the state of Alabama figures its weather out and the Lord helps us out a little bit. Then you're on the road the next week. Then you're back home for Kentucky. That's November 1. It's cooling off at that point. So other than homecoming, home games at Jordan-Hare, weather-wise, should be pretty nice, Auburn, which is nice.
Auburn, just be good. Get a night game at Georgia. Then get a night game for Missouri. Then just get a night game for Kentucky, right? I mean, simple game.
I don't mind the early afternoons, the 2:30s.
No, but just from a heat perspective, if you are going to take it that far, why not? Let's play it under the lights.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Auburn doesn't play Missouri or Kentucky at 11 a.m. at home is a miracle, I would say. I think that is...
They'll find a way to edit this.
They'll find a way to change
vetoed.
It. Yeah, well, Auburn fans should be excited about this, man. Night game against Georgia at home is going to be a big deal. Other games on there as well that are exciting for Auburn, too. And so go check that out. You can go find that on the Auburn football social media pages. They tweeted out a nice graphic with that. We will take our final break, come back and wrap up hour number one, and then get into hour number two. That's all coming up here on the Wednesday edition of On the Line.
You are on the line on ESPN 106.7. Call in at 334-321-1390 or toll free at 888-382-7502.
Wrapping up hour number one here on ESPN 106.7. Just a couple of minutes before we get to hour number two, where we will talk about some rules changes in college basketball that were announced and approved. I guess that was late yesterday afternoon, where the coaches' challenge is now in college basketball. We'll talk about that in hour number two. And then it's Double D Wednesday with Darrell Dapperich. He'll join us from Locked On Auburn in the Barn. We'll have him on for 30 minutes today. So looking forward to that, as we always do. And man, there's a lot to talk about with him. And speaking of schedules, right, we were talking a little Auburn football scheduling in terms of the time windows and the time slots that have been announced by the SEC and some other great games throughout the year as well. But that got us looking at the Auburn basketball schedule just for what we know as of right now, with some of the games that Auburn is going to be playing. Some of the smaller ones that have kind of been quietly announced, they'll have Nichols on there. Wofford is on the schedule. We know that they're going to play that tournament out in Las Vegas, but some other big-time matchups that we've talked about a couple of times.
Yeah, again, you mentioned it. Nichols on November 6th, Wofford on November 11th. Those are kind of your tune-up games before you go to Birmingham on November 16th, where you will take on Houston. You then go to that Players Era, the NIL Invitational Tournament in Las Vegas. That's Thanksgiving weekend, where you could play four or five games depending on your success. And if it's the same rules as last year, which I would imagine that it is, the winning team gets $1 million towards their NIL fund, which is a very new school way of having these big time tournaments. Yet you're going to see tournaments like that continue to have so much success. And let me pull up the...
The field has grown. It's like tripled what it was last year, right? It's like 36, 34 teams, something like that, that are going to be competing in this thing around Thanksgiving?
Just 20, or it's 18. But it's Auburn,
Alabama. What am I thinking of? I thought there were more than that.
I don't know. But it's Alabama, Auburn, Baylor, Creighton, Gonzaga, Houston, Iowa State, Kansas, Michigan, Notre Dame, Oregon, Rutgers, San Diego State, St. Joe's, St. John's, Syracuse, Tennessee, and UNLV.
Good Lord.
That's a Sweet 16-esque field right there that you're going to basically be playing in late November. That is absolutely insane to think about. You continue to work your way down. Right after that, you go to Tucson. You go to Arizona on December 6th. You then have, I would imagine you'd have a game or two in between these two dates, the 6th and then December 20th against Purdue. That's in Indianapolis. And then December 29th against Queens. You'd also have the SEC ACC Challenge sometime in there in December. But really, really exciting looking at some of these schedules. And, man, with as much basketball as we've talked, it just feels like it's – you're ready to see this team get back on the hardwood.
Yeah, they're going to have a stacked non-conference schedule once again, and you hope that they can manage it anywhere near like what they did a year ago. It helps you come NCAA tournament time. All right, hour number one's in the book. Stick around. We got more coming up in hour number two. Talking rules changes in college basketball, plus Daryl Dapperich from Locked On Auburn and the Barn for Double D Wednesday. That's all coming up right here in hour number two.
An Auburn Network production. You are on the line. Live on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader. Online at ESPNAU.com or on the ESPN 106.7 app. To be on the line, call in at 334-321-1390 or toll free at 888-382-7502. You are on the line with Jacob Goins.
You're on the line here on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika sports leader. Happy Wednesday, everybody. Hope you're doing well as we get underway here in hour number two during On the Line on ESPN 106.7. I'm your man, Jacob Goins. Across from me is Christian Griffin. We appreciate you being with us. And if you missed any of hour number one, you can go and catch up with the podcast version of the show on our station website at ESPNAU.com. In hour number one, we talked about the U.S. Open that begins tomorrow at Oakmont, where if the winner shoots under par, it'll be a miracle. We also made our picks for the U.S. Open and picked some bigger names. Also made a prediction on who might miss the cut as well in terms of big names. Also had some exciting news for Auburn baseball with a returner who was a star-studded freshman who decided to come back for another season, according to his social media. So talked about that a little bit and what that could mean for Butch Thompson and the boys coming up next season. And then Auburn football has their time slots announced from the SEC. We know who, we know when, and we know around what time for most of them, including a night game in Jordan-Hare for the Georgia game. And so all of that was in hour number one. If you missed it, you can catch up with the podcast. We post that for you on our station website each and every day at ESPNAU.com.
We also talked a little bit about Auburn basketball and their hoop schedule so far. And here in hour number two, we're going to start it off talking about some college basketball rule changes. The coaches challenge is here. We're going to dive into that, what that could look like for the games, what that could look like for the under 2 minutes, what that could look like for those two-hour TV windows that just everybody seems to love. There's also some talks on possibly going to quarters like every other sport does everywhere. How will that impact college basketball as a whole? How will that impact Auburn and the SEC? Going to talk about that before we get to Double D. Daryl Daprich, who will join us at 3:15 to talk all things Auburn athletics. We're going to get his thoughts on these rule changes. Also, Auburn baseball, his thoughts on just how the Super Regional was hosted, regardless of maybe the final scores for the Auburn and Coastal Carolina game, but just how much credit goes to Auburn and the staff, and then again, getting his thoughts on these rule changes as well. But before we get into any content here in the second hour, we want to remind you that it's brought to you by our friends over at the Orthopedic Clinic. The Orthopedic Clinic is East Alabama's go-to center for orthopedic care, with locations in Auburn and Opelika to better serve you. You can find them online at theorthoclinic.com. So we appreciate them for sponsoring the second hour of our show here each and every day on ESPN 106.7. Christian Griffin, Jacob Goins here with you in the studio. And Mr. Goins, the two-hour time slots have brought up a little bit of frustration over the years, whether that be the three-hour games that you have to witness or it being the game that's in front of your game where you don't get to watch until there's 4 minutes left in the first half. And the first step to trying to speed that up is the coaches challenge. It is here. It is now a part of college basketball from this year moving forward.
Yeah, and I think it's something that's been in the works for quite some time. We see it in the NBA, right, where they initiated the coaches challenge, the light, right, the green light that they put in a while back, and the fact that coaches in basketball have now been able to challenge the ruling on the play, ruling on the court, ruling during the course of the game. And we've seen it like it is in most other sports, with a challenge that if you use it, you don't necessarily lose it, but if you lose it, you lose it, right? If you make the challenge and you lose, you don't get it back. But if you challenge a play and you win, you get it back. We've seen that in most other sports across this country. In college basketball, will now be the same, to where a coach is able to challenge an out-of-bounds play, a goaltending or basket interference call, or a I think a flagger, right?
It says whether a defender who was in the restricted area during the foul. And again, you have to have a timeout to use it, and so that will be another key strategy, because coaches basically want to keep a timeout in their back pocket throughout the remainder of the game. Officials can still take over under the two-minute timeout to go and look at possession and things like that, but again, I agree with it. The one question I have is, it is a little bit different than the NBA, because in the NBA, you can challenge foul calls. What we've heard about in college is not being able to review or ask to see if that was deemed a foul or if it was whatever the case may be. It is simply, it says that coaches can challenge out-of-bounds calls, basket interference / goaltending, and whether a secondary defender was in the restricted area during a foul.
I would assume that's coming. I bet they're going to see how it goes, and kind of that's what the NBA did, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. They built on it as it went. And the main article that you need to look at, in my opinion, is the one from Jeff Borzello on ESPN, where these two sentences right here is what really sticks out to me. about this idea of the coaches challenge now being a thing in college basketball. It says, quote, while officials can still initiate video reviews on goaltending and restricted arc plays in the final 2 minutes of games, out-of-bounds reviews can now be initiated by only a coach's challenge.
Oh, so referees now can no longer even go look at it under 2 minutes to deem whose ball it is.
What it says, officials will also continue to use instant replay for timing and scoring issues and flagrant fouls. But this says, again, while officials can still initiate video reviews on goaltending and restricted arc plays in the final 2 minutes, out-of-bounds reviews can now be initiated by only a coach's challenge. That speaks to me and tells me that unless the coach challenges it, the officials cannot go and look it out of bounds. There's no more of, well, we called it off of Texas, but I mean, I guess it could have deflected off of Bama. Let's go take a look. Let's just go take a look real quick. Let's just go look at the monitor super quick. We'll be fast, I promise. We'll be right back.
Go ahead and get your commercial breaks.
Yeah, go ahead and take a break. Go ahead. We'll be back. Let's go talk to the people in Birmingham. Let's get four people. You're gonna look at it, and then let me walk away, and then you look at it, and then I'm gonna walk away, and then you can look at it. Okay, what do we decide? Did it hit his jersey or not? That's gone. It's from what I read, from what I'm hearing, from how I've talked to some people about this already, that seems to be out of the question, unless a coach says, yeah, you missed that call. I want to challenge that. I have a timeout. I still have my challenge. You're wrong. I want to challenge the ruling on the play.
Can the NBA do it where the official, because like the official's timeout, the official's challenge basically to go and check, or is that the exact same way to where it's only a coach's challenge that determines that under the two-minute timeout? Because I completely agree with it being the first 18 minutes of a half being the only way that we go back and look at it is with a coach's review. But you would think under 2 minutes you would want to confirm getting the call right. And so then it's going to create a really big issue when a coach doesn't have a timeout and it was clearly off the other team.
Yeah.
And that ends up coming down to possibly a win or a loss. Another thing that stood out to me is in men's basketball, you have to have a timeout to use a challenge. In women's basketball and in women's college basketball, a timeout is not required for the challenge. But if you don't have a if you don't have a timeout and you still deem to challenge and it's unsuccessful, it's a technical foul.
I don't hate that, because I don't love the rule of having to have a challenge and a timeout. You basically have to have two things to challenge the ruling on the play, but the call on the floor, I guess. But the idea is, okay, what's your punishment for getting it wrong? Your punishment's losing the challenge, in my opinion. If you have a challenge, you should be able to use it. If you don't win, you lose the challenge and you're done. Love the idea that if you win, you get it back. You should be rewarded for correctly challenging the ruling on the court. Well, that's interesting. I hadn't seen that part about the women's side of things where you don't have to have a timeout. So if you have a timeout and you get the challenge wrong, you lose the timeout.
It goes as a timeout, yes.
But if you don't have a timeout and you get the challenge wrong, it's
a technical foul. Yeah, towards two free throws in the ball.
I don't hate that either, especially down the stretch, too. Yeah. Then you really have to sit and think about it and wonder, do I really want to challenge this?
And how long until we've heard plenty of people talk about it. I think Richard Jefferson was one of the initial founders of this idea, because we see it all the time in every single sport, whether it's baseball, basketball, football, where if a player disagrees and immediately gives the home run signal,
the
finger twirl of the, hey, go look at this. Or you cover both ears of, hey, review this. Okay, all right. Yes, sir. We're going to go review it right now because you told it to. It's like a timeout. Yeah. If we're playing 5-on-5 basketball and I'm trapped in the corner, I call a timeout. It doesn't matter if it was the head coach. It doesn't matter if it was an assistant coach or one of the players on the floor. If they call a timeout is granted. How long until, he fouled me. Review it. Okay.
It just gets old seeing that. Yeah, every time somebody hits the floor, it's review it. Or every time it's out of bounds, review. Like, so I get it. He's basically saying that would put it to its
It would put it to bed right of the arguments and the please go look at it. Please. Okay. Yeah. The first time you do it, the first time that finger goes up, we're going to go review it. And that would help with coaches as well.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, we'll talk some more about this with Daryl Dappert coming up here in just a moment. Also, it says there is a positive momentum for men's college basketball to move to quarters instead of the two halves, which would match every other level of basketball in the world. Hopefully that is something that is on the way as well. But we'll talk some more about that with Daryl Dappert, plus some of the football news, baseball wrapping up that season as well. We've got 30 minutes and a lot to go over with Double D, Daryl Dappert for Double D Wednesday. He joins us coming up next here during the Wednesday edition of On the Line.
War Eagle, this is Auburn baseball coach Butch Thompson, and you're on the line with Jacob Goins and Auburn Opelika sports leader, ESPN 106.7.
And we're back here on the Wednesday edition of On the Line on ESPN 106.7, and it's one of the favorite times of the week. I know it is for us. I've been told by many of you it's your favorite time as well. It's Double D Wednesday with Daryl Dappert of Locked On Auburn and the Barn. My man, it's so good to have you back on the air. Second time I get to talk to you this week. I mean, something good as a Bruin if I get to have you on twice on the radio this week.
Man, it's special. It's almost like we're going back to the football season where we get to talk more than once. We get to share little rye bread, Chex Mix, and hot tamales. It's all good, right? I mean, soon we'll have.
Yes, well, we are, what, 80-something days away from the start of Auburn football, and unfortunately, athletics have basically come to an end. Auburn track and field's got some things going on, but in terms of the major sports, the athletic season has come to an end, and I presented this question to an earlier guest this week and want to get your take on this, just your overall summary of what we saw across the major sports for Auburn in 2024 and 2025. That's football, men and women's basketball, baseball, softball. I mean, just across the board, your overall summary of what we saw this past athletic season.
I think you have a reason to be like cautiously optimistic. I think it was a better year than last year, except for football. I think basketball really, really helped remedy some of the sour taste that we got at the end of that football season by going to a Final Four and all the championships, you know, the tournaments and stuff Auburn won. And then I think softball was much improved. You could see hope. This team was a lot more fun to watch. They swung the sticks. They hit a lot of home runs. They were offensively proficient. So they were fun. I mean, even though they didn't have the kind of year they wanted to have, they still got to the championship of a regional. And you could just see that they're building, that the Malvos are building something there. But, you know, they just were fun. They were a lot more entertaining. I mean, they hit the long ball. They scored. They came back when they were down late, have comebacks. So that's fun to watch. Of course, you know, baseball, feel a little bit like that there was something left on the table. You got to tip your hat to Coastal Carolina. But I feel like Auburn at the end of the day, had they been able to take a little bit more advantage of runners on base, and even won that game one that went to midnight or whatever, could have been a completely different series once you get it to game three. Mm-hmm. But I think overall, when you look at a team that basketball went to the Final Four, baseball hosted a super regional, softball showed much improvement. With the buzz that's going around with football now, with these preseason, these preseason predictions and some of these players that they're talking about going in the first round, and I think that there's hope. So, and then, of course, you know, the Nike thing that kicks in July 1st. So I think overall there's an air of optimism, and there's an air, and that's what makes this NIL collective and this house, settlement agreement and all that interesting, because where a lot of colleges will dump 85-90% of this revenue into football, Auburn's in a unique situation where they got to spread the love a little bit more because of the way baseball and basketball has come on the last few years. So that being said, I think you'll probably see, of course, football is still going to get the lion's share, still going to be heavy, but I think Auburn will spend a little bit more on basketball and baseball than traditionally maybe some other SEC schools will.
And Daryl, you mentioned Coastal Carolina and Auburn. Auburn season coming to an end inside Plainsman Park. History not necessarily going how you wanted it to, but history still made with Auburn hosting its first ever Super Regional. We've talked about so much credit goes to the athletic department, the game day staff on
building the terrace in right field, getting all of the general admission, the standing room only. I mean, it was such a fantastic event. What were your overall thoughts from this past weekend, I guess aside from the 2-0 sweep?
Well, there, you know, it's multiple components that are taken into consideration when the NCAA, I feel like, seeds you, because they know that at some point, if you get through your regional, you got to host a super regional. So, yes, performance on the field matters. But I think they also look at what kind of host you can be, what you can bring to the table as far as accommodating fans and customers and guests and other ball clubs into your stadium. So it comes into play. They look at facilities. They look at venues. They look at how you host. And Auburn absolutely acquitted itself tremendously for any future super regional bids. I mean, obviously, you have to be good enough to be ranked in the top eight. But my point is if you're number nine or you're number 10 and the other number eights or number nine is not on par with what we saw last weekend and the tremendous environment and atmosphere and the temporary seating and all the stuff that Auburn did to make that whole thing and pull it off flawlessly and be special, it matters. And it gives you a little bit of a boost to host. I hate to keep going back to, you know, to make this about a West Coast thing, but I know that as long as I've followed Arizona baseball, and they're considered a blue blood, they've won four national titles, they probably should have won a fifth, they don't get to host super regionals, the most they ever, because they play in a minor league ballpark. And I think that ambiance and that atmosphere and packing it out and how they host, it's just not the same as LSU, Florida State, Mississippi State, these on-campus stadiums. So Auburn did a great job. They acquitted themselves well. It was, in my opinion, it was an audition, and I think they came through with flying colors for anything that happens in the future.
Well, Darryl, why don't you just bust out the checkbook and fund a baseball stadium for the Arizona Wildcats, a team that's playing in Omaha? They need to have their own stadium. It can be named Double D Stadium.
They do have their own field, and I went there growing up as a kid. I went to that stadium and went to that ballpark. It's beautiful, and I don't know why they refuse to just play there or upgrade it, because it is a nice ballpark, and they just moved off campus, and I'm talking about 10 minutes to 15 minutes off campus to where the Tucson Toros used to play and the Cleveland Indians used to have spring training. If you've seen the movie Major League,
yep,
that's the ballpark. Okay, I actually played. I've been blessed enough to play on that field, play in that ballpark in some playoffs, high school playoffs. So, yeah, it's nice. It's got a big-time feel, but it's not a home field advantage at all. And I just, teams that do that, it's a head-scratcher, and I think it costs programs super regionals when they don't have that campus environment. I really believe that.
Darryl Dapperich of Locked On Auburn in the Barn here with us on ESPN 106.7 for the Wednesday edition of On the Line. We're going to talk some basketball coming up in the next segment, but you mentioned the house settlement, right? That seems to be the huge conversation going on right now. You and I had a chance to sort of get into this on Monday during Auburn Opelika this morning over on News Talk WANI, but just your kind of your takeaways now that we've had several days to kind of sit in and soak all this in of what exactly this house settlement is in terms of revenue sharing, and you mentioned it a little bit on how schools are going to diversify and kind of share the money around it and spread the wealth, if you will. Just your thoughts on this whole revenue sharing house settlement stuff that happened last Friday night.
I think it remains to be seen, because I think that the intent was to create a little bit of parity, but I don't think that's going to matter. I still think having NIL collectives and with being able to subsidize this revenue sharing and still having NIL collectives, you're still going to have the bigger schools outspend. Where it's going to be interesting is, let's say a school like Vanderbilt. All right, they get $25 million. What are they going to do? Are they going to spend 20% in baseball, 20% in basketball, and 60% in football when everybody else is doing the 80-10-10 model? And I don't like the baseball component of it. I think that everybody wants to jump on board and go, great, you go from 11 scholarships to 30 scholarships. Okay, well, they're also taking six roster spots away.
Mm-hmm.
You can only carry, you know, I think it was used to be able to carry 50. Now you can carry 44. So with NIL, you could still get that kid's school paid for, but now you don't. Now you don't have six guys on that team, so that's going to trickle down. Will those guys? Will they go to mid majors? Probably. You know, the number 45th or 46th roster spot on Vanderbilt probably plays at Troy or Louisiana. You know, I think I would rather see the scholarships and the roster spots stay at 50, because anybody that knows college baseball, especially with these midweek games, you better have enough pitching. You've just taken six roster spots off of that. So, I don't know. That's not a trade-off that I like. I would have rather seen both happen. More scholarships, but keep the roster size the same for baseball. Football, I think the amount of scholarships that you could give, and there are roster limitations as well. There's opportunity. I get it. It's just a trickle-down effect. If a kid really, really wants to play at Auburn and they didn't mind not being on scholarship, but they made the team, now they're going to have to play down maybe. Now they'll have to go somewhere else. Either in a lesser conference or, you know, a mid-major. So, I don't know. There's some components of it that will reel in some of it, but I still think that there's enough NIL collectives and things that people can get creative and create loopholes where you're not going to see the parity. You're not going to see the Kentuckys, Mississippi States, Vanderbilt. And you know, as Auburn fans, do we care? I mean, because Auburn – for all the lack of success they've had on the football field the last 5 years, they're still considered a big boy program. And, you know, they still are considered in revenue and attractive, getting people on campus. So, you know, I want to see whatever's best to kind of propel Auburn, but also have a little bit of parity so it's not the same teams year in, year out.
And Daryl, it's something that Jacob and I have talked about kind of throughout the week, and it feels like a little bit of an uncomfortable conversation, but it's something that has been completely avoided. We have not heard much about it, but it's the whole Title IX deal when it comes to this whole settlement clause. Kirby Smart has mentioned it. A couple of the other coaches have brought it up as well. I mean, how far away are we from a team canceling the women's lacrosse team or the men's track and field team to be able to pay for one of those top end quarterbacks? Or do you think there will be some sort of figuring it out as you go to where a couple of years from now there won't be that sort of issue?
That's where your NIL can be your safety net, because you can still, because look, as much as I love the big three, having daughters and having coached high school volleyball, sure. I love and grew up watching, you know, softball, and I love, you know, the women's sports are exciting to me. Mm-hmm. I love going to volleyball games and softball games and girls, but I think it's important, and I think it does not need to be lost in all of this. Now, there's some other elements of that that could take away federal money that I'm not going to get into, that you guys could probably figure out, connect the dots with legislation, depending on certain types of student athletes in the Title IX thing. But as long as it's equitable, and these sports need to be around, there needs to be women's lacrosse. There needs to be, you know, women's soccer. And I mean, look, anybody that's had daughters, how cool is it if your daughter loves soccer and she's a high school soccer player? Well, what do you want to do? You want to take her to an Auburn soccer game, a women's soccer game. If you coach travel softball, I can remember coaching travel softball and taking the whole team to an Auburn women's game, and they got to play meet the players, yeah, and meet the coach, and, you know, got to go down on the field with them. Same thing with volleyball. I took a girls team, volleyball team, to South Bend and played in a tournament, a national tournament in South Bend, Indiana. And just happened to go and sit in on a Notre Dame women's volleyball practice, and they invited us down on the court to practice with them.
That's awesome.
I don't care about wins and losses at the end of the day. I don't remember how we finished in that tournament. But I do know that a lot of those girls, probably their first time ever out of Alabama, remember that moment and getting their picture taken with All-American Notre Dame volleyball players. And so those moments matter, and they better not go away. They better find a way to still fund those because of Title IX, because I think it's that important. Well, I'm a huge advocate of female sports.
I'm same way. I mean, my younger sister plays travel softball up in Birmingham. My other younger sister up there she competes in travel gymnastics. I mean, she's in multiple big clubs up there. I mean, I'm the same way. I mean, and look around here too with, like you said, softball, volleyball, gymnastics. I mean, all these different women's sports that you don't want them to go away, and I don't think anybody does. There's so many question marks, and that's a big one with the settlement that happened on Friday night. We're just going to have to wait around and see and just learn as we go and see what happens with all of that across the entire landscape of college sports. We're talking with Double D, Daryl Dapperidge from Locked On Auburn and The Barn here on ESPN 106.7. We'll take a break, come back, and talk some basketball as the roster is set. The makeup's a little bit different, and some rules changes came into effect yesterday. That's all coming up here on the Wednesday edition of On the Line.
You are on the line with Jacob Goins on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader.
30 more minutes here on the Wednesday edition of On the Line here on ESPN 106.7. I'm Jacob Goins. Across from me is Christian Griffin, and we are joined again by Daryl Dapperidge, Double D of Locked On Auburn and The Barn. He's with us every Wednesday, 3:15 to 3:45. Plug it on, my friend. Tell him where you are, what's going on with the quote-unquote offseason, but I know that's not a thing in your world, as it's not in ours.
Yeah, we cover Locked On Auburn Wednesdays and Fridays. I'm with Zach Blackerby. We do some recruiting. There's some different, you know, recruiting weekend visits, and some athletes came in, some players came in yesterday, Tuesday. So I think there's some components of that we still talk about. And then we talk about, you know, there's a lot of love coming the Auburn Tigers way, these preseason predictions and some of these mock drafts and all that. So we've had a lot to discuss. And then on Sunday night, at 8 o'clock, Kyle Rush, Zach, and I go live on what's called the Barncast, and we just kind of recap Auburn athletics the week there is. It's going to be challenging now that there's no, you know, sports going on. But look, like we've talked about before, we're about 3 weeks into getting ready for SEC Media Days.
Yep.
So, or actually a month, but that's when it all starts to really ramp up.
Well, you mentioned football recruiting, and do want to get your thoughts on that very quickly. I forgot about that. The fact that Auburn picked up two commits this week, one in the class of 2026, a running back from the state of Mississippi, and then a four-star safety from down in Mobile in the class of 2027 who flipped from Florida State to Auburn. Your thoughts on a 2026 running back and then a 2027 safety flip?
Well, the running back, Eric Perry from Mississippi, really under the radar, a three-star, underrated, dynamic speed, missability in open spaces, really makes you miss. Play quarterback, but he'll play running back at Auburn. And I think that one of the recruiting experts that Zach has on his show made a really good point about the state of Mississippi. Geographically, it's so large, but there's a lot of small schools that it's hard to get to and see everybody. So a lot of these kids go under the radar, and we're you know, Georgia's concentrated in Colquitt County and Atlanta, that area, and It's just different in Mississippi. So you can't get everywhere and see everybody, and these kids get missed. And good for Auburn for finding this kid. And, you know, his offer list was not impressive. I think it will be. I think you'll watch the other schools will jump on board now and start having him come for visits and give him offers, but he is very, very quick, about 6 foot, 190, very elusive, and he will be another running back, you know, obviously to go with Henderson and Mapson next year, maybe perhaps Cobb as well. It'll be interesting, but he's a good player, under the radar, diamond of the rough kind. And then Jalen Scott is the four-star safety that flipped from Florida State. Alabama kid, loves Auburn, has loved Auburn for a long time. So he's the first 2027 kid in the class, but he's a good get. And I was telling Zach on a show that dropped this morning on Locked On Auburn, Auburn's secondary recruiting has almost become ho-hum with me. I mean, I hate to say that, but I don't get as excited as I do when they get an offensive tackle or a receiver or, you know, a linebacker, because they've done such a good job of getting an influx of secondary kids on campus, getting them to commit, and then getting them to play right away. It's been a really an embarrassment of riches in the secondary. So he's another one that Auburn's very high on, and it's a good opportunity, a good flip to get from Florida State.
Well, that's what the month of June has become around college football recruiting, with the month of July basically non-existent anymore in terms of a dead period now. And so Auburn football and Hugh Freeze continuing to recruit at a high level, and they'll be able to do so even more if they can get some wins on the field this fall. But definitely want to start talking some basketball, as we now have the official roster put together from Auburn basketball, the names, the numbers, the height, the weight, everything we need to know about this upcoming Auburn basketball team for Bruce Pearl and the Tigers in 2025 and 2026. And something that Christian and I were highlighting yesterday was the fact that there's one true center in Emeka Opurim, a lot of forwards, and a lot of guards on this team. When you look at it just across the board, heights, weights, numbers, everything, Daryl, what stands out to you about how the makeup of this Auburn basketball roster is different from a year ago?
Well, Auburn will have to win differently than they did last year, but they actually, it's more of a Bruce-type roster. I mean, if you think about it, he went with Broom as his center 2 years ago, who was 6'10", same size as Keyshawn Murphy, who's 6'10", more of a four, projected as a four in the NBA, but he was forced to play Broom at the five 2 years ago. This year, he played with a true center. I can remember years that he had, you know, Macklemore that played like the five, but he still went a little bit smaller. The Aubrey Wiley year, where he was a true five, is only the only other year. So he's won by playing a traditional four at the five, a guy that's 6'9", 6'10", and not your typical center. And I think that's what he's going to do this year, because no way is Freeman, Jovich, and Murphy going to be off the floor. I think that somehow, and Hall and Pettiford, I mean, somehow you're going to have to make those five fit, you know, and you've got Bashir coming off the bench and Overton coming off the bench. So I think that it's different, but it's not. If you followed Bruce Pearl's teams, it'll look familiar. He's played that four, that typical big four at the five position. And especially, you know, Jovich, if he plays the four, he's 6'9". Freeman, 6'8", can jump out of the gym. So you're not going too small in your front court. Hall is 6'7", 6'8". So it just depends. I think that Freeman or Jovich will, one of those two, Jovich, one of those two will come off the bench. And I think Keyshawn Hall will play the three. I think Overton will play the two because he's such a good defender, the transfer from Texas Tech, and he's such a good rebounder. He's a big guard, a 6'5". So you'll bring Bashir off the bench. You'll bring Magwood off the bench. You'll bring either Freeman or Jovich off the bench, and then you'll bring the big center you talked about too. So Auburn, I think, will go 9 deep, 10 deep, but they'll just look different. But it's not anything we haven't seen before in previous Bruce Pearl teams.
How would you compare versus contrast wanting to use tempo, right? It's something you've seen so many years with this Bruce Pearl type of offense, but it technically or traditionally works a little bit better when you have that one key rebounder. All of a sudden you find your point guard with the outlet. All of a sudden you're out and running. It's a 3-on-2, 2-on-1 type of fast break. When you don't necessarily have that key rebounder, and there might be four or five guys that average four or five rebounds a game, how do you compare? How do you contrast using the tempo versus making sure you're not a defensive liability on the rebounding side of things when you're still trying to score points on the other end?
Well, I think Auburn will definitely still be able to have, you know, Murphy is one of the leading rebounders in the SEC last year, so he could be your dude. I think Freeman and Jovich can still get him, get boards. We talked about Overton being a really good rebounding guard. Hall can rebound. Auburn will have teams in hell. They're going to go transition this year. They're going to be very, very fast, and they're going to be able to when they bring guys like Bashir and other guys off the bench, Magwood. They're going to be able to go fast. They're going to be able to go tempo. And they're going to have to. I think they'll remember the Auburn teams that would go tempo and then get out in transition, and it would drive me crazy, but it was a formula that worked. Rather than go tempo and go in transition and go really, really fast and go to the rim, they'd pull the ball back out and shoot threes. That Harper, Bryce Brown,
yeah.
You know, they'd have a 3-on-1.
And they'd shoot like, the three.
City. and they would stop and kick it out to the three-point line
yep.
and shoot threes. And I asked Bruce Pearl about that one time, and he said, well, if you're 3-on-1 and you got a guy shooting a three, you still got two guys to get the rebound.
What a great answer.
It drove me crazy, though, because I'm like, go to the rim.
Yeah.
You know, you got a 3-on-1, and they would stop and kick it out behind the three-point line to take the three. You may see some of that with a Bashir and a Magwood and a Hall. Now, you know, Murphy and Jovic and Freeman are going to go to the rim. They're high flyers. They're dunkers. That's why I like this team so much. There's so much versatility. On a fast break, you might be able to pull it out and kick it to Bashir at the wing or Overton and let them shoot the three. And if defenses start overplaying on that, then they'll go to the rim and dunk on your head with Freeman and Jovic. So there's a lot of flexibility in multiple positions. Guys, like I mentioned before, can play the three and also play the two. The rebounding question, though, I think Auburn will be fine. I think they're so athletic and still have some size. I mean, if you start 6'10", 6'9", and 6'9" down low, you're okay. And that's the potential. And then a 6'7" or 6'8" two guard, if they go that route,
sure.
they'll look and see who they play. And if they need to go small, they'll go small. If they need to go big, they'll play four forwards with Pettiford.
Well,
so
wow.
It'll be a pretty one that four out type thing, one in, four out that they've used before offensively.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be fun. I will say this team may not have the seasoned veterans and the leadership and what we knew with familiar faces and familiarity, but this is a team that's going to be a lot of fun to watch. It's going to be very entertaining. Showtime from this Auburn basketball team.
Well, they're going to look a lot different in terms of what the roster makeup is with Auburn basketball, but not the only thing that looks different, because some rules changes were approved late on Tuesday afternoon yesterday, where a couple of things are going to be different in the game of college basketball. And the main one, Daryl, is coaches' challenges are now here. Listen to this. It was approved on Tuesday where coaches can now challenge at any point in the game out of bounds calls, basket interference, and goaltending, and whether a secondary defender was in the restricted area arc. The description and breakdown of this says, while officials can still initiate video reviews on goaltending and restricted arc plays in the final 2 minutes, out of bounds reviews can now be initiated only by a coach's challenge. Your thoughts on this entire idea and the game changing as we know it?
I like it because you don't have to wait till, remember, they would continue to play on, and then you would have to, the next dead ball, they would go and look and see if the goaltending was there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the points come. I like handling it immediately while it's fresh in the official's head. I don't think it's going to slow down play that much. I think it's going to have Pat Adams in shambles, and that's going to be hilarious. Because if I'm a head coach, every call he makes, I'm challenging.
Because you're going
to
win.
To make him mad just because I know he's missed it. Pat Adams might like it because he gets to go immediately while all eyes are on him and go to the camera and people look at him when he goes to the monitor. But I wish there were other things that they could challenge. I get those are arbitrary. Foot on the line. The restricted area thing. I mean, traveling is one that you can't challenge. You know, by God, you should have been able to challenge double dribble.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think that I don't want it to get into foul calls, stuff like that. Restricted areas enough on an offensive charge, stepping out of bounds, deflections, right? I mean, if a, you know, how many times do they go to the monitor over and over to see if a ball went out of bounds? They'll still do that, but there are times that they don't look. It doesn't get challenged. And so now if a coach feels like they may have got the call wrong on a deflection or who did it touch last, maybe they have recourse to look at it now. I don't care that it stops the game for 30 seconds or whatever. Get it right and not wait. Don't wait till timeout. Don't wait till a dead ball. I think go ahead and address it right then. So that'll help with that. I don't think it'll change it too much, though. I really don't.
Well, there's a lot of things to be excited about with the upcoming college basketball season, whether it's the season as a whole or just this Auburn team in general. And not that we want to wish anything away of college football season, but basketball will be exciting. Football is right around the corner, and so is SEC Media Days. Believe you got your credentials and everything, right, Daryl? Did you get everything set
good.
Up and ready to go?
All good, ready to go. It's going to be very interesting to see if the local SEC media has as much love and believes as much as some of these national outlets do in Auburn.
Yeah.
When these all SEC teams come out, where the rankings are, where Auburn's going to finish, there has been a tremendous swelling of people really, really believing in Auburn, not only with mock drafts, but also with where they'll finish and their playoff predictability. And it's going to be interesting to see if the local SEC media feels that way as well.
That's going to be coming up in Atlanta the second week of July, July 14th through the 17th. We got our stuff. We're going to be there. All three of our shows, of course, the Max Roundtable with Doug, Christian, and I will be there for OTL, and then the Drive is going to be there as well. So we're looking forward to that. We're going to talk to you several times between now and then, Daryl, but always appreciate you hopping on our show every single Wednesday, 3:15 to 3:45 for Double D Wednesday with Daryl Dappert, my friend. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll talk to you again next Wednesday, okay?
You guys have a great one. Take care.
You are on the line on ESPN 106.7. Online at ESPNAU.com or on the ESPN 106.7 app.
Winding down here on the Wednesday edition of On the Line on ESPN 106.7. We appreciate our man Daryl Dappert for Double D Wednesday here on ESPN 106.7. Always a joy talking with him, catching up on a lot of things going on. You could tell he is he's very passionate about what he believes in, and we love that about him, and a lot of things with Auburn as well. And it's been a great show today. We have had a jam-packed Wednesday on the line where we've, of course, talked to Daryl. We've talked about the rules changes in college basketball, Auburn football in terms of the schedule with the time slots that we now know for all of the games this year. I think we're up to, what, 4 kickoff times officially now for Auburn, the first 3 games, and then the Mercer game.
Yeah, the
before,
game.
Yeah, before the Iron Bowl. And so slowly but surely we'll get those kickoff times, but we at least know when around about time will be for those. And so a lot of that today, some baseball news. U.S. Open starts tomorrow as well. I know that's going to be a lot of fun, and it's always cool when the major falls on Father's Day weekend. I know that's what my dad and I enjoyed doing, watching a little golf together, and so looking forward to doing that on Sunday. And so, if you missed any of it, check it out, ESPNAU.com.
Game 3 of the NBA Finals tonight.
Back in Indy, baby.
As I say, back in Indiana. I saw something that said that in the finals, the game 3 winner, we've talked about how important game 1 is, but I saw stuff that said that the game 3 winner wins 85% of the time, which is a...
No matter what the series is?
I don't know if that's if it's 1-1.
Yeah.
Or I would imagine that would be what it was, because if it's 2-0 and you get back to 2-1, but I guess it would make it to where...
Or if you're up 2-0 and go up 3-0, I mean,
right,
that would,
so you would
that
figure
would
that,
it
or it
way.
Would be, at worst, you're down 1-2. I don't know.
I mean, it's a best of 5 now.
Yeah,
it's best of 5 with the Pacers having home court advantage. That's what happens when you steal a game on the road. So because it's the 2-2-1-1-1. And so Pacers are, we say back in Indy, it's in Indianapolis for the first time in this series. And so you could catch that radio broadcast if you would like to tune in right here, ESPN 106.7. Game time, I believe, is 7:30. They'll go on the air at 6:30, an hour pregame with ESPN Radio. So looking forward to that. We'll have some of that for you tomorrow. We'll also have a couple of good guests. We'll get Brad Law on here talking, kind of recapping the season and year as a whole, plus talking some of the basketball news, the football schedule as well. Also have Chris Gordy on here. We'll have a lot to talk about with him, and then a whole lot more. So that's going to be right here, 2-4 on ESPN 106.7. If you missed the show today, again, check it out in the podcast center on our station website at ESPNAU.com. We are back tomorrow, 2-4, right here on ESPN 106.7. Until then, he's Christian Griffin. I'm Jacob Goins. Stay safe. We'll talk to you later.